Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Vietnam War has never been far from the political career of Senator John Kerry. It was close at hand this week in Iowa. It will be there again if he faces George Bush this fall. Tonight on Point, Vietnam and John Kerry. Historian Douglas Brinkley frames the man and the war in Tour of Duty. But first, WBUR political reporter Fred Tice spent the day today following the other Vietnam veteran on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. General Wesley Clark spoke in front of veterans and later before students at the University of New Hampshire. Fred Tice, what did you hear from the general today?
Well, the general laid out a plan for Iraq in front of the students at the University of New Hampshire, in which largely he said he would involve NATO nations and create a new political authority similar to the United Nations, but not the United Nations, that would oversee a transfer of authority, a much more gradual transfer of authority in Iraq to an Iraqi government.
But Wesley Clark, the former four-star general, saying, let's get NATO involved. Fred, it's a very different picture in New Hampshire this week from Iowa last week. Wes Clark wasn't even there. John Kerry had a surprise win in Iowa, of course, and Howard Dean a surprise poor third-place showing. What are the latest polls showing out of New Hampshire on where these guys, and John Edwards as well, Joe Lieberman, stand now? Well,
the latest University of New Hampshire poll, which was just released within the hour, shows that the lead that Howard Dean had is rapidly shrinking. You're now seeing him and Kerry pretty much tied for first place. Wesley Clark seems to be maintaining his position at about 18% of the vote in New Hampshire. That's different from what a Boston Globe poll released this morning, the tracking poll from the Boston Globe, showing that Clark is also gradually losing support as Kerry gains momentum in New Hampshire. And yes, both polls show that John Edwards is having difficulty trying to make something out of his victory in Iowa. At least he's having difficulty making something out of it in New Hampshire.
So the University of New Hampshire poll as of today, the latest, Dean 29% support, Kerry 27%, nearly neck and neck in poll terms, Clark at 18%, John Edwards at 8%, Lieberman at 5%, and Kucinich below that. So we've got essentially at this point what looks in the polls like a two, maybe a three-way race here with two veterans in it. Now, Wes Clark has been drawing some fairly pointed comparisons between himself on this military service front and John Kerry in the last couple of days. Of course, Wes Clark was a general. John Kerry was a lieutenant in the Vietnam War years ago. Yesterday, Fred, I'm sure you saw this, Wes Clark said, nobody in the race has got the kind of background I've got. I've negotiated peace agreements, led major alliances in war. It's one thing to be a hero as a junior officer. He said he respected John Kerry, but he went on to say, I've had the military leadership at the top as well as the bottom. He was a lieutenant in the Navy, and I was a four-star general in the Army. Let's hear what General Clark had to say today.
I'm not trying to draw a distinction between my rank and Senator Kerry. I'm just saying that we were both young officers in Vietnam. We pursued different paths of public service. He pursued the path of elective politics. I pursued the path of staying in the armed forces. My experience is experience in executive leadership. And as I rose up through the armed forces, I was in positions of authority where I actually had to bring people together, set tasks, motivate and supervise the accomplishment and achievement of our objectives. That's a leadership function. It's about activity. And I think it's very relevant to the responsibilities of president.
Fred Tice, you were there today as Wes Clark gave this follow-on to his fairly tough criticism yesterday or distinction drawing. How uncomfortable was he with his questioning about military service, the quality, the relevance?
He seemed to be quite bothered by the question, and you know, he was sort of doing a backhanded way. He was still hammering in the distinction today, mm-hmm. as we just heard. Mm-hmm. While he's saying, hey, we were both lieutenants, he's essentially saying, but then I became a leader while John Kerry became a politician.
A different kind of leader, not a military leader, and he's saying there's a difference. Fred, I don't know how close you've been to the Kerry campaign in New Hampshire. How is John Kerry carrying his military history, his military record. How front and center has it been? It became a big deal in Iowa when the man he pulled from the river 30-odd years ago showed up just days before the vote. Is it front and center in New Hampshire?
I have not been so close to John Kerry's campaign. We know that we've seen television ads in New Hampshire showing highlighting Kerry's Vietnam experience, having some of his buddies talk about what kind of man he was, and so he's clearly playing it up on the TV. I don't know how much he's taking it to the crowds, however, because I've not been following him there.
But fascinating to watch these two men, very different military experiences, very different experiences of Vietnam, for that matter. Wes Clark was not there all that long, and not with the same kind of intensity as John Kerry, but sort of weighing against one another the significance, the relevance to this campaign of their military service. Wes Clark's legs in New Hampshire, he's still going strong, Fred.
He is still going strong. I wanted to say something about this, the relative significance that mm-hmm. they lay about on this. Clark, every time he speaks to an audience, almost glides over his Vietnam experience. I mean, he sort of has an aw shucks, yeah, I was in Vietnam, I came home in a stretcher, and then I went on and had a great life.
Went on to glory.
And he also talks about his life before Vietnam to a great extent.
West Point, poor boy.
Arkansas mm-hmm. roots. I'm mm-hmm. a Southerner, mm-hmm. you know, it can carry the South. Those are points that he really hits on. He's really not hitting the early military experience, the Vietnam experience.
So the Vietnam ticket is punched here, but it's not the key element in Wesley Clark's military background. It is the key element in John Kerry's. It will be interesting to see how this plays out in the days ahead. Fred Tice, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
Fred Tice is covering the campaign in New Hampshire for WBUR. We'll be talking with him over the next few days as we move into that primary vote. February 1966, Yale senior John F. Kerry enlists in the U.S. Navy. February 1968, he requests duty in Vietnam. December 68, wounded in action, Purple Heart. February 69, second Purple Heart. 8 days later, charges a Viet Cong sniper, Silver Star, for valor. March 1969, rescues a drowning comrade under fire, Bronze Star, for bravery, third Purple Heart. May 1970, joins Vietnam veterans against the war. September 2003, Senator John F. Kerry announces his candidacy for the U.S. presidency against a sitting president who sidestepped Vietnam and the Texas Air National Guard. This week, Kerry wins in Iowa and Vietnam is back again. Tonight on Point, the new Democratic front runner and the legacy of a distant war. How does a chest full of medals from Vietnam figure into your assessment of John F. Kerry? What should Vietnam War experience mean in the years of Iraq War and George W. Bush? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Orleans, Louisiana, is historian and author Douglas Brinkley. His new book is Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War. Good evening and welcome, Douglas Brinkley.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
It's terrific to have you. You've got quite a load of great books under your belt. You've written on history on so many fronts, written with Stephen Ambrose, who's written, so memorably about war. And now comes Tour of Duty, Douglas Brinkley, focusing on John Kerry's experience in Vietnam. Here it comes right into the teeth of his presidential campaign, into the heart of the primary season. I guess the first question I've got to ask you is, what's the origin of this book? Is this a contract book intended to land just as the campaign hits up, or something else?
Well, the idea of this book came to me a couple of years ago, really, and I wanted to do. I run the Eisenhower Center, and we have a large World War II oral history collection, mm-hmm. meaning we've interviewed veterans of D-Day and Iwo Jima, Okinawa, Battle of the Bulge, on. And I wanted to shift gears as director and start looking at the Vietnam War, interviewing not just Vietnam veterans, but also the anti-war movement, and particularly how veterans protested in Vietnam. And the first project we launched with Ron Drez, who was a captain at the Battle of Khe Sanh in the Marines, is just looking at Khe Sanh. We've interviewed now 150 men at the Battle of Khe Sanh. I went a different path. I wanted to start doing what I thought would be a book on the Vietnam senators, these guys that fought in Vietnam, got decorated, came home and used their Vietnam experience to catapult them into electoral politics.
And there are a number of such senators, what, four or five at this point?
There were. When I thought of it, it was John McCain, Max Cleland, Bob Kerry, John Kerry, and Chuck Hagel. But at the very time when this was all coming together, McCain wrote his own memoir, a very good one. A biography came out on him. Also, Bob Kerry got into an atrocities controversy.
Yes.
Stories in New York Times Magazine and Newsweek. He ended up writing his own memoir, and there's also a book about his experiences. Max Cleland did a memoir. And it was really John Kerry and Hagel whose stories weren't told. And at that time, I went and spoke with Kerry's chief of staff, a fellow named David McCain, who has already written a book of his, two books of his own, one on Clark Clifford and one on Tommy the Cork Corcoran, both Democratic characters. And he told me, well, if I'm going to interview Kerry, I may want to ask him about his diaries from Vietnam. I had never heard about them. And he said, well, I haven't read them, but I know they're very voluminous. I've saw them once, glanced at them, but he just keeps them in his closet in Boston. So at the end of my interview, I asked then-Senator Kerry, he had not yet announced for the presidency, if I could look at those. And he said, let me think about it. I tried to convince him I was a historian looking for relevant material, not I gotchas in your diaries. Mm-hmm. And I kept at it, number of emails, letters. And eventually he invited me to meet him at Boston where the archive is. And at that point he said, look, I'm too busy and to even go through this stuff, but go ahead. And with no strings attached, except I do something with it, write a book, an article. I wasn't sure whether a publisher was going to be interested in a book fully. I forged forward, and I was just taken with the excerpts. Some of them appeared in the Atlantic Monthly in December, but just from the diaries of this Yale graduate class of 66, how brilliant the writing was and how much anguish and angst one felt about being what he called an uncommitted soldier. And I realized that his experience was seminal. I mean, it was sort of what many Vietnam vets felt. And then with Kerry, I not only had the story of Vietnam and the Mekong Delta and these riverboats, which is quite dramatic, but also the second half of the book is about how did he come home and try to heal the wounds of Vietnam and forge a – became to the national consciousness as the leader of Vietnam veterans against the war.
Douglas Brinkley, the book is complex like the man, like the war. It is also, on the whole – rather laudatory. I just want to be sure that we understand the timing of this book coming out in the heart of the presidential campaign season then is accidental or?
No. At that point, when I went to the publisher, there was Kerry. It was very clear that John Kerry was going to probably run for the president, but we couldn't take a chance. I mean, he won Iowa, but it didn't look that. I was being laughed at in November.
Right.
The book reps weren't dying for tour of duty.
You picked
just
the wrong horse,
ago.
Brinkley. Right?
Yeah, I got a lot of that in the fall. So if I'm lucky right now, so be it. But the concept for the publisher was for me to get done when I could and to bring it out. We were at one point aiming for June pub date of 2004, and I think wisely, my editor Claire Wachtel at William Morrow very said, no, we got to get this out. That you know, Kerry may not even be around in June, and if there's any interest, let's get out as soon as we could. So I didn't finish it until October, and they had it ready in January
on the shelves in a hurry. You open the book with a number of quotes, but one from the Bible, from Psalm 49. I will set my ear to catch the moral of the story and tell on the harp how I read the riddle. Why this at the beginning of a book on John Kerry in Vietnam?
Well, Vietnam is sort of a riddle. And when I was reading the diaries, it dawned on me that, for a few things. One, that at one point in when he was very young, Kerry thought about being a priest and has always had an interest in not religion in the sense of, almost as a scholar, somebody who studies the history of religion. It's something that interests him a lot. But more than that, there's a great the riddle for this, for Kerry in his war diaries, is how I've been bred with a sense of public service. His father was a foreign service officer, and he had bounced all over the place and was taught this sense of that you serve your country in duty. And President Kennedy had told a generation, pay any price and bear any burden. And how does one do that when you're being drafted and you do your duty in uniform, yet what you're fighting for, you don't understand. And the more you learn about it, the more you disagree with it. Do you go AWOL? Do you quit? Do you abandon your so-called brothers in arms? And so there was a great riddle of Vietnam was how to escape it alive and move on with your life.
All the more interesting when a young man, enlists at that time. Doug Brinkley, stand by. We're talking tonight with Professor of History and Director of the Eisenhower Center for American Studies at the University of New Orleans, Douglas Brinkley. His new book is Tour of Duty, John Kerry in the Vietnam War. How much do you see John Kerry's Vietnam experience of 3 decades as shaping his views today? How does a chest full of medals from that war shape your assessment of John Kerry? We're at 1-800-423-8. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Vietnam and John Kerry, about this week's Democratic frontrunner and the legacy of a distant war. My guest tonight is Douglas Brinkley. He's author of the new book, Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War. You can join our conversation tonight. How important is John Kerry's military service in your assessment of the man, the candidate? And how do the war heroes' anti-war protests figure in? Democrats, do you want a man who wore the uniform to challenge George Bush? Why does it matter? Does it matter that it was this war, the Vietnam War? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Douglas Brinkley, there are a million complex and rich threads that run through this book. It is quite a story, but I wish you'd outline it for us, for people who don't know it at all, just in brief, how John Kerry came to be in those rivers, under fire, in Vietnam, coming home with that chest full of medals. What brought him there?
Well, John Kerry was born in Denver, Colorado. His father was a pilot, and a test pilot during World War II, and contracted tuberculosis. And it's emblematic that Kerry kind of bounced around a lot. Nobody really realizes he was born in Denver. But so his father flew planes, had a sense of military obligation and duty during World War II, stayed in government, and went on to be a Foreign Service officer. So the young Kerry you meet in my book is a guy bouncing around New England, where he was lived in a number of different towns, then spent a little time in D.C., then went over to Berlin and Oslo with his parents, was in boarding school in Europe, came back and went to prep school in New Hampshire. After that, he was accepted into Yale University, and he was the class of 66 at Yale. I make a big difference between the class of 66 in Yale and, say, the class of 68. In 66 in Yale, Vietnam War, anti-war movement hadn't hit its peak yet. Johnson in 65, it was when he really increased the troops and was just starting to foment.
Kerry, so the anti-war movement was not really underway. John Kerry enlisted in February of his senior year, not even out of school yet.
Right. And these guys and his buddies there at Yale was Dick Pershing, the great-grandson of General Blackjack Pershing of World War I fame, and Freddie Smith, who is today the created and is the CEO of Federal Express in Memphis. Mm-hmm. These three guys, they were all in Skull and Bones, the secret organization at Yale, right. And their notion of serving your public was very much both in Kerry's family life and with his friends Pershing and Smith. They never really had a tormented moment, and the thought process was, you know, this is our time. We've got to join, not to go fight in Vietnam, but to do our stint, our military service.
Kerry went to the Navy and was not in Vietnam at first. He eventually requested that. What took him from the enlistment to that request?
He was sent to Newport at the training center in Newport. From there, after training, he was stationed in San Francisco. And it's kind of interesting part of my book. Here's Kerry in San Francisco during the Summer of Love and that period, and with Fillmore West and the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. And he then his job there is to learn if a boat gets a hole in it, torpedoed, how to patch it up, really. They then went down. It was home-based out of Long Beach, California, and he was assigned to the USS Gridley.
Guided missile frigate,
the Gridley, and they left. He was there for a while. The frigate was stayed home-ported, and then eventually it went on its Pacific mission. It left in January of 1968, and it returned in June of 68. And Kerry wrote a lot of letters home, which are in my book, and started keeping a kind of diary of his time, although he had kept one, slightly kept one while he was at Yale. And wrote these, you know, what he was learning. It's really a young adventures of a young man at sea in many ways.
But you write, Douglas Brinkley, that he found this frigate duty essentially tedious. He wanted to get out, as you say, of the Black Shoe Navy and have a command of his own. Question for you. John F. Kerry was famously interested in politics and ambitious in that direction from a very young age. He was famously admiring of John F. Kennedy, and you have photographs in your book of him standing near Kennedy at a sailing event somewhere. There were social connections. Was John Kerry looking for his PT-109? Was it explicit? Was he trying to recreate the heroic experience of President Kennedy for political purposes?
That's a good question. There's no person that he admired more than John F. Kennedy, first off. And as you point out, there's a photo in my book with him with President Kennedy. While he was in college, he was dating Janet Auchincloss, who was the, related directly to Jackie Kennedy, as a stepdaughter. So it was he had this connection to the Kennedy, and coming from Massachusetts and whatnot. From a military point of view, I don't think it really dawned on him, although when he was in the Gridley, he used to read the radio reports. And one of them I found in his archive was a radio report about John. He got on the intercom and said, attention, good morning, we are now going through the Solomon Islands. This is where the PT-109 incident occurred. Mm-hmm. So clearly he knew about it. Here he gave a written report about it when they were going through the Solomon Islands.
Man's mind, that history was branded there.
I think so. And when he then got to Da Nang, where they were in the Gulf of Tonkin, what really clicked, I don't think it really clicked that he could have his own PT-109 sort of thing, but what did click is he saw cruising across the harbor these brand new 50-foot Swift boats. Mm-hmm. Swift boats are all aluminum. They were the new PT boats of this Vietnam generation. They started being manufactured where I'm at in Louisiana in 1965 and were tested on the bayous here. And they were basically being made to go to Vietnam for coast patrol.
This is kind of offshore patrol at first.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They were built for that, for the blue waters. Vietnam had over 1,100 miles of coastline.
I want to push quickly ahead to that. John Kerry applied for Swift Boat School in California and returned to Vietnam in 1968, now not an ensign but a lieutenant in charge of his own patrol craft.
Correct. And he trained in Coronado for Swift School and was sent in October 68 back to Vietnam. Now he had his own boat.
But the mission had changed. It was no longer that blue water offshore duty.
The key here is he didn't think he thought this was an easy billet. He wasn't looking for glory on the Swift boat. They were doing like Coast Guard patrol off Vietnam, where you would stop commercial vessels and inspect them, like our troops are doing in Iraq today. A car comes. Do you have your papers?
Right.
You go through the checkpoint.
Admiral Zumwalt had other ideas.
And he had just launched what's known as Operation Sea Lords, and it makes up a good portion of my book. They suddenly said, you know what? The Viet Cong aren't smuggling stuff down the coast anymore because we control the coast. And these Swift boats that were part of Operation Markentine worked. Mm-hmm. What we now must do are take these boats and send them up into the Mekong Delta River system, because if you look at a map, the river system of Vietnam is extraordinarily complex. It really is like the Ragged Boot Hill of Louisiana, mm-hmm. a real vast marshland, wetlands, canals, incredible waterway system. And this was where the North Vietnamese were sneaking contraband into the South and supplying the Viet Cong guerrillas.
Douglas McCary, you've got so much data here, and our time is limited, but I want you to take us and give us the thumbnail then of those incredibly intense handful of months between the end of 1968 and late spring 1969, when John Kerry had his trial by fire. Give us the highlights of that so our listeners can understand, and then I want to forge into the turn he took when he got home, or even began to take, I guess, intellectually while he was there. But on the action side, give us the rundown.
Well, he got assigned Operation Sea Lord based out of Antoy, and suddenly they were doing these boat convoys up to go look for the VC, and they were getting shot at all the time. One of the reasons was these boats could be heard from 2 miles away. The riverbanks were filled with mangrove thickets. So if mm-hmm. you were a VC with a grenade launcher, you'd hear the roar mm. of the boats coming. You'd go to the shore and you'd pop them.
Here it comes,
and
sitting duck.
High death toll. This was now the most dangerous duty in the U.S. Navy Kerry found himself on. And he's so frustrated, he's trying to keep the morale of his men up. And he's also writing in his diary of his frustrations with policy. But he's following his superior officers, and he gets in constant scrapes. I mean, his boats are getting plugged, filled with mortar rounds constantly. He gets wounded, as you mentioned at the outset of the program,
yep.
three separate times, and won 3 Purple Hearts. And then there were any number of wild and and disturbing incidences that occur. One of them is when at night a boat was in a curfew zone and Kerry doesn't know what to do and the men shoot at the boat. It surprised them and they come upon it and find that it was just rice and women and children. And Kerry writes about seeing the dead child there that their boat killed and how it's going to haunt him. One of the men on the boat I interviewed, Jim Wasser, told me that it's Christmas Day and they were trying to just go take their boat to see the Bob Hope show. And instead they got hit by rounds of enemy fire. They fired back, but they, you know, Wasser fired on one side and realized all he did was end up killing an old man and an ox. And he's been haunted by Christmas. He can't enjoy because of that death. There are moments of what we call battlefield heroism. The rescuing of Jim Rossman, which has been in the news this past week.
Oregon policeman who showed up in Iowa on the eve of the caucuses there. Kerry got a bronze star for that, for bravery.
That's right. And those, they hit, you know, the big thing the VC were doing was mining these canals and rivers. So the biggest fear was, when beyond being shot at, was just getting your boat blown up. And this, the mines went off. They were enemy fire everywhere. Kerry got smashed, his whole arm up. It was just mayhem. One of the boats got completely devastated in the convoy. And Rassman was a Green Beret that Kerry was just carrying on board at that time. And he fell into the water and Kerry went and saved his life. And was quite moving this past week in Iowa because kind of an unrehearsed moment. Rassman decided, you know, he actually saw my book Tour of Duty in a Los Angeles bookshop and then decided to contact the Kerry campaign and showed up there. He's a Republican who is now, you know, putting his name behind the Kerry campaign.
Because John Kerry pulled him out of that river. And then February 28th, 1969, the Silver Star, a very high medal in the U.S. military. For what, Douglas Brinkley?
Well, essentially, what happened was they were being fired on again, and what they were supposed to do when fired on was keep going straight ahead. Well, Kerry felt that made for too wide of target for their boat, and this time he saw this guy pop out of a spider hole on the side of the riverbank and start aiming a B-40 rocket launcher. So in split seconds, instead of going forward, which would have certainly been killed, he ordered the boat turned completely and rammed the boat into the bank. It so startled this VC that fast maneuver he ordered, then Kerry leapt off the boat and started chasing the fellow who was trying to get a little distance from the boat to fire at it again, and Kerry shot him dead on the spot and confiscated the rocket grenade launcher. And for showing such such quick wittedness under intense pressure, he was awarded the Silver Star. He saved his boat, saved his crew, and took out the enemy.
And aside, in 1996, that day became controversial in a re-election campaign for the U.S. Senate. There were charges that John Kennedy had shot this Viet Cong soldier when he was down, that he had shot him inappropriately. How do you resolve that in your book?
It's just nonsense. I mean, I can only judge by interviewing every single one of the men, and even the Boston Globe, which was quite had raised this at one point. One of the reporters, the new reporter who covered it for the Globe, found a guy Frederick Short down in Arkansas who all the reports of these guys are the same. So it's sort of Kerry, I think, was getting picked on in a political campaign for that particular incident, saying he shouldn't have killed this guy that had the B-40 rocket launcher at him. It seemed to me like a cheap shot by the press.
And then three Purple Hearts, two high medals. John Kerry requests to be moved out of Vietnam. He comes home, and before long, he is one of the most, perhaps the most prominent Vietnam veteran anti-war spokesperson in the country, Douglas Brinkley.
That's correct. My book is all about a young man in his 20s, and you always have to keep that in mind. Everything he's doing is a story of one young man dealing with Vietnam of his generation. Kerry spent a year. Once he returned after his third Purple Heart, he lived in New York City with his fiancée, Julia, and he ended up working in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and he got to travel to Greenland and Panama and other places. So he was an admiral's aide. But he was having nightmares about Vietnam. He was anguished. The anti-war movement had hit a new peak. Nixon, instead of getting us out of Vietnam, was committing us more into Cambodia and Laos. And finally, Kerry asked to get out of the Navy a year early. His admiral granted him that, a very liberal admiral to do that, I might add. And Kerry point blank told him, I want to get involved with politics. Mm-hmm. I want to get involved with the anti-war movement. And he then became a leading spokesperson for VVAW.
And in his very first, very public appearance before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, April 1971, a scathing critique not only of his experience in Vietnam, but of U.S. policy in Vietnam, essentially accusing U.S. policymakers of being war criminals, the war being entirely misguided. And then the famous haunting question he asks, how do you ask? This is to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He is 20 what at that point, Doug?
I believe 26.
26.
Yeah.
How do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? There's so much history here, Douglas Brinkley, but fast forward with us now to 2003, 2004, a new race for the White House, for the presidency, and this Vietnam vet in the race, something he'd thought about for much of his life. What is the unique perspective in your mind that John Kerry brings to this race at a time of a 50-50 nation, the red and blue nation, the Iraq war, and great disagreement over that war? What does it matter that John Kerry had this experience of war heroism, war protest?
Well, my book's called Tour of Duty because in World War II, you would do your duty. You came home, you had a victory parade, and you were, you were given the GI Bill, and you went on with your life. You felt good. You defeated Hitler. You defeated Tojo. In Vietnam, these guys got back and had no parade. They were given reports of Agent Orange occurred. The VA hospital got filled up. People were complaining about all sorts of illnesses, and they became disliked, really. They were considered the losers, the Vietnam generation. These are guys that lost the war. And so they've never really healed these Vietnam vets in many ways. And there are 10 million Vietnam veterans in the United States. And Kerry never forgot his tour. Dude, Vietnam, just because suddenly for political reasons, Gerald Ford says it's over, let's evacuate Saigon. That did not mean Vietnam was over for these veteran psyches and for their health. I mean, they've had to deal with the legacy of Vietnam for their entire lives. Kerry, as a U.S. senator, went and worked with John McCain looking for POWs and MIAs and filing the famous over 1,000-page report, went actually to Hanoi and went under Ho Chi Minh's tomb looking for possible American prisoners or remains, doing whatever he could to bring dog tags back from Vietnam. He then went forward and worked with McCain to normalize relations with Vietnam, to create the first educational programs to heal the U.S.-Vietnamese relations. So that's his tour of duty is only ended in Vietnam when he got closure. And it's been difficult for this generation to get closure. And they see in Kerry, when you go in Iowa and see that all the men that are there with him right now in New Hampshire, the guys from PCF 44 and 94 are all over New Hampshire. They're with their commander.
These are his swift boats, his river boats in Vietnam.
The river boats guys are all there with him, and it's a generational statement. They served, and they know what it was like to come back, and Kerry never forgot about the Vietnam vets, and they're there for him now. They were there for John McCain earlier.
Is it window dressing, or is it for real? Is it genuine?
It's very, very genuine. I mean, because we as a society, try to put Vietnam behind us. In fact, President George Bush once said that with the Gulf War, the first President Bush, that the Vietnam syndrome is over, meaning the syndrome of losing. Where, that's inferring that these guys are losers, the Vietnam vets. And Kerry being a winner means something for them. With Bill Clinton, who we had the issue of Vietnam was raised with the dodging the draft. And this is a different battle going on now. And I think Kerry's making a lot out of it when he says, I know something about aircraft carriers for real. Veterans like that kind of language.
Douglas Brinkley, stand by. We'll be back in just a moment. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Vietnam and John Kerry. Douglas Brinkley's new book is Tour of Duty, John Kerry in the Vietnam War. You can join our conversation. Is it time for a Vietnam vet to sit in the White House? Would a Vietnam veteran bridge the 50-50 nation or split it? And is John Kerry, Vietnam vet, the one to solve Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about this week's Democratic frontrunner and the legacy of a distant war. My guest is Douglas Brinkley. He's professor of history and director of the Eisenhower Center of American Studies at the University of New Orleans. He's author of the new book, Tour of Duty, John Kerry in the Vietnam War. You can join our conversation as well. Does a chest full of medals from Vietnam factor into your assessment of John Kerry, presidential candidate? Why do you differentiate between the military service of John Kerry and Wesley Clark? And how do you draw the line from Vietnam to John Kerry's vote authorizing the invasion of Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation now Dan Payne. He's joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a contributing columnist for the Boston Globe and Mass Insider. He's former media advisor to John Kerry. He's worked on and off with him for 30 years now. He's also a political analyst for WBUR. Good evening and welcome, Dan Payne.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you. I'm actually in Newton tonight, Cambridge.
Oh, very well. In Newton, Mass, then. Dan, you know the work that Douglas Brinkley has done, and it's quite a telling of John Kerry's story, and he tells it with great verve, casts a ton of light on it here. And yet, at the end of it, we're asking, what is the relevance of this to this campaign season, to the decision that Democratic voters will make now, perhaps American voters will make this fall? How do you see, having worked with John Kerry as you have, the significance of this war in his background? What does it matter today, Dan Payne?
It is, for John, sort of the central experience of his life. It defines who he was before, during, and after.
Even though those months in Vietnam were what, four months at full fury, a few more on either side, even though it was relatively short?
Yes, because it was so searing. It was so, life and death hanging in the balance. And the associations he made there, I mean, the friends, and then the friends by extension that he's made since, define his, his view of the world and his view of himself. He cannot escape it.
So it would be, it has been with him as a senator, it would be with him as a president.
Absolutely. And were he to stray, were he to forget his service, he has with him in every campaign a group of Vietnam vets who call themselves the Dog Hunters, who keep John, on the straight and narrow.
And what's the straight and narrow as the Dog Hunters, these fellow Vietnam vets would see it?
Well, they were founded 20 years ago in a political campaign that I think John Kerry would have lost had they not come to his aid. They keep John Kerry grounded. They let him know that there are people out there who are trying to live a decent life, but who are struggling, who don't have work, who may not have housing, who aren't where they'd like to be in life. And yet when John needs them, they come forward. They were there. I saw them on the stage in Iowa. They will be with him in New Hampshire. They will go wherever he needs them. And they're very important to him because they remind him that life is not as simple as it sometimes seems when you're a United States senator.
Douglas Brinkley, you've been deep into John Kerry's diaries from that time, his correspondence from that time. When you look back at what he was writing then, how do you think the experience, the memory of Vietnam might inspire him if he were in the White House? How might it trouble him in the White House in a time of war in Iraq?
Well, first off, I agree with everything that was just said. I think it was just said perfectly. I mean, he lives with it. To say, well, it's only this many months or this, I mean, he saw life and death, people's spirit leave their bodies, saw carcasses burning, the fragility and what it means and the responsibility that one has of committing our young men and women to battle, how one has to be very cautious when one does that. That's the gravest thing that somebody could do. This is our national treasure, or our young people, and that one has to be very, very sure about it. So I think it gives him a sense of caution in foreign affairs. Yet he's somebody very globally involved, working on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, wanting to see the United States, I think, partner with other countries. The fact that in my book, it ends with him working so hard to establish this friendship with Vietnam and the United States, and it's now happening, and Vietnam is starting starting to get have a thriving economy, and we're having educational exchanges. I think he sees that as the way it can be in the world, that we can learn how to be friends. And I think but it takes effort.
He has a very good friend, Tom Vallely, mm-hmm. who I'm sure Mr. Brinkley knows or knows of, who runs the Vietnam program at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And Tom Vallely and John Kerry have made many, many, many flights to Vietnam.
14, if I recall correctly, from Douglas Brinkley's book.
Yeah, and they and he's done it with other senators and other vets. Mm. But the purpose of this is, well, it's twofold. On one hand, they want to make a contribution. They want to do something. But on the other hand, it's part of the healing that they feel they need to go through. That this war has not left them, that they are not satisfied with their lives, their lives relative to that war, and they want to do something. And there's another sort of slice of people in John Kerry's life, many of whom he's met in the Senate, but elsewhere, who want to help him because they feel that we still have an open wound over Vietnam.
So there's a band of brothers there. We get that. But I also want to get at how this informs his view of his morality, his philosophy. But we have a lot of callers who want to join us, too, and we've got to turn to them. Bruce is calling from Boston. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, you use this phrase, and it's really telling, about America being divided today, 50-50 nation. Mm-hmm. But, I'm 5 years younger than John. I went to high school in a college town, and we were sort of thrust into stuff that we didn't understand.
That is, Vietnam War.
Yeah, during the Vietnam War. And John taught, I think, my generation, I hope, but me particularly, two things that I think are important to the healing of the nation. You know, we felt that if you weren't part of the solution, if you weren't opposed to the war, actively
right.
fighting it, mm-hmm. that you were the enemy, mm-hmm. that you were part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And that meant that a lot of people felt that our soldiers were the enemy and that our government was the enemy. And I know that sounds melodramatic, but that's the way that at least the student movement was in the country.
So has John Kerry's lifetime in public service inside the government helped you bridge that divide then between those years of protest?
Not only that, but more than that. First, he showed us then that the people that were in uniform could be heroes even if the war was wrong, and that they were our heroes and that we needed to embrace them. And second, by, I guess, the first run for Congress that he made, that the role for people that wanted change was in government, and that it was the people's job to correct government when it was wrong. And in a very, very profound way, John taught me respect for men and women in uniform and respect for public service. That's, I think, affected my life dramatically, and I think has made it possible for healing to happen to the extent that it has.
Bruce, we hear it, and we thank you for your call. Dan Payne, here's a very contemporary view. Bruce is saying the whole idea of even if you oppose a war, you respect people in uniform. Wholly contemporary in Iraq. This is almost the whole nation's attitude at this point. John Kerry is the embodiment of that, but is that also he's taken a lot of heat and had some difficulty explaining his vote in authorizing the war in Iraq. Is it also a source of tension, of conflict for John Kerry?
Oh, absolutely. Vietnam has been a part of every campaign John Kerry has run. And both sides of Vietnam, by the way. John is not just a war hero and a friend of vets, but he's also a peace warrior. There are people in the peace community in this state and around the country who look to John Kerry as a leader, as a permanent leader.
And voted against the Gulf War in 91.
Yeah, and he, you know, the vote that he cast to go to war in Iraq, he has a hard time explaining it because I think fundamentally he isn't sure whether this is the right thing, whether that was the right thing. And he still is struggling with it. He's gotten a little better at explaining it, but still there's a tension in him. The warrior, the warrior who picks up a gun and the warrior who picks up the daisy. I mean he embodies the American I don't know what you want to call it, schizophrenia, perhaps, about Vietnam.
Douglas Brinkley, I hope you can take us back to his writing from the time of Vietnam to the kind of thoughts then that may haunt him now or inform his view now of Iraq.
Well, I think when he got arrived in 68 and Nixon was coming in, the Nixon administration, the buzzword in Vietnam was Vietnamization. You know, it's not we're going to get out. We're leaving soon. But first we're going to teach. We're going to Vietnamize, you know, Vietnamization. And we're going to train them how to be fighting people. And that was the illusion that that was going to work. And I think the problem in Iraq can become what is Iraqization? And I think Kerry sees it that way, that that, you know, yes, it's good that Saddam Hussein is gone. Yes, it was a horrible regime, but can we impose democracy? Can we build a civil society in Iraq? And how long will that take? And it rings his Vietnam bells in the sense that it didn't work there, that if we're going to do it in Vietnam, we went alone. Our European allies were against us. Let's not go it alone in the Middle East. If we're going to experiment in democracy building in Iraq, let's bring as many people as long as we can, particularly NATO and the United Nations.
Jane is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I'm thinking, as I'm listening to all this and as I watch with such wonderful, great interest how well Kerry did in Iowa. I'm head of a military family group in Madison, Wisconsin, and I also know many people have been in Vietnam.
A military family group, meaning you have a relative at war now?
I have a relative, and I am head of a group of families that have sons and daughters and husbands overseas, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Who do you have overseas, Jane?
My son.
Where is he?
He's leaving February 10th for Kuwait, and then he will be in Iraq, and he's a Black Hawk pilot.
So when you see John Kerry, what do you take from his status as a Vietnam vet, the way he carries it?
Well, I'm thinking that God moves in a mysterious way if he's going to vindicate and make good the Vietnam vets that I know that have come back, that have been mistreated, and that still carry the scars. And I just hope and pray that all the Vietnam vets will work for him for president, because I think it will be so wonderful.
If it would be him. Jane, thank you very much for your call.
The thing about John and war that I think will inform his candidacy and I hope his presidency is that he knows what it's like to lose, you know, a human being who one instant before was standing next to you and the next instant is gone.
He lost his Yale buddy Dick Pershing that Douglas Brinkley mentioned earlier.
Absolutely. And he saw people gunned down in front of him. And when you have that experience, it changes you forever, and you never look at the war in quite the same way. Now, he can talk about it in ways that are similar to perhaps the way John Edwards would or George Bush even, but he feels it differently.
But he's been accused of some opportunism in that vote last fall. What do you make of that, Dan Payne?
Well, I think he was genuinely conflicted, as I said before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that he is satisfied with what's happened. I know he's certainly horrified by the way Bush has conducted the war. But as I said, the fact that he hasn't been able to explain it clearly means that he hasn't come to grips with it. He doesn't know whether it was the right thing. But you can be sure that he knows now what he wants to do. I mean, he wants to get troops out, and he's got a plan for doing this. And the other thing I wanted to mention is you started the program by talking about General Clark's comments about
mm-hmm.
John.
Mm-hmm. We're different. I was a general. I negotiated with heads of state. He was an officer in the field. Great for him, but not the same.
Right. But he's made the mistake, the fundamental mistake in dealing with John Kerry in a political context. He's touched the third rail of John Kerry politics.
But isn't he right at some level? I mean, these are very different roles that they've played in the military.
Yeah, but one vet does not speak ill of another for his service.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, as people have pointed out, there are a lot more enlisted men out there than there are generals. And this is a dangerous course that Clark has begun. I hope it doesn't open up at the debate tomorrow night in New Hampshire.
We'll be watching that. Douglas Brinkley, we have one more minute. I want to ask you this question. When John Kerry announced his run for the presidency, Max Cleland was there, the man who lost two legs and an arm in Vietnam, a fellow veteran. He pressed the family Bible into John Kerry's hands and said to him, "You've got to win. It's your duty." And you quote John Kerry whispering back, "I know, I will. I won't let us down." Why, in Max Cleland's mind, does John Kerry have to win?
Max Cleland got into politics because of John Kerry. He was had in caisson, a grenade took both of his legs and an arm. He then saw Kerry that day on television testifying, and he was stunned to see somebody that was decorated protesting the war. He became close to Kerry, and they found themselves as a group of brothers, these Vietnam vets, and he gave the family Bible in a very emotional moment privately, which I got to witness firsthand to Kerry, and John Kerry keeps that with him all over the campaign trail.
And it's still that experience binding. Douglas Brinkley, author of the new book, Tour of Duty, John Kerry and the Vietnam War, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Dan Payne, contributing columnist for the Boston Globe and Mass Insider and political analyst for WBUR, thanks for being with us. We'll talk to you again.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.